I'm Charlene. In these 20-minute podcasts, I talk with memoir writers about their books, their lives, and their writing process. Sharing like this helps us all connect. As we listen, we learn about the world through the eyes of others. Their stories help us expand our views and empathize more deeply with each other. It's my pleasure now to invite you to listen in to this episode of Life Story on Soul Sciences. Hello, listeners. I'm here again today with Brad Warner, and I'm having a delightful conversation with Brad. He wrote several books, one called Sit Down and Shut Up and Don't Be a Jerk, and I approve of that title. And the second book that I'm more familiar with and have read is Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. Welcome back to the program, Brad.
Thank you for having me.
Brad, we were finishing up last time around a notion that has to do with how long Buddhism, including Zen, including all of the meditation techniques, have been washing into the Western culture. You were saying that it's probably since about the 1950s. Would you help us understand a little more clearly how the Western psyche gets into a little trouble trying to adapt to some of these practices?
It's because, I mean, everybody brings to any situation all their biases and their culture and everything. And this is talked about a lot in the media and mainstream internet talk. So realizing that, you kind of can't help but look at it through a lens of, well, I'll give you my own example. Maybe that helps. I wasn't raised any sort of religion at all. You know, I was one of these sort of, we were vaguely some kind of Protestant, you know, and that's what my family was like. And I think that happens a lot in North America these days, you know, that we never went to church or anything. But even so, I constantly find myself looking at Buddhism through the lens of Christianity, because Christianity is sort of part of the culture. Yes. So even though I'm not trying to.
That's right.
And one of the most interesting things, which I wrote a whole book about a few years ago, was this notion of God, mm-hmm. which I put in all of my books because I find it really interesting. That sort of idea of a monotheistic Christian, Islamic, Jewish sort of God that never really caught on in the eastern half of the world, you know, from India on out. So, but. There are aspects in the Buddhist tradition in general, but definitely in the Zen tradition, which sound like it's referring to something like God, but they don't call it God. And the reason I bring this up is because some of the earliest people who interpreted Buddhism for Westerners would say Buddhism is a religion without a God. And in a sense, that's true. There isn't this idea of a creator God who sits on a throne up in heaven. But to say it's without any sort of notion of God would be wrong, because there is a kind of a notion in there of something much bigger than ourselves, to which we are all connected, and that the universe is not a dead place. It's actually, life is something that isn't just something that belongs to what we think of as living things like ourselves or plants and animals, but life is everywhere. You know, it's almost like the Native American notion of the spirit being everywhere. That's I think infused throughout Buddhism, and you know, that's one of many ways that it can kind of go. I wouldn't say go wrong. I almost said go wrong. It doesn't exactly go wrong, but it's a different sort of approach. And when approaching Buddhism through that mindset, you just have to be careful and notice how much you might be reading into it of your own culture, and then try to say, okay, well, let me step back and try to see this thing for what it's trying to tell me, you know.
Yeah, that sounds like very, very solid advice. Now, one of the things that I'm aware of is the student-teacher relationship. Would you speak to that, both from your perspective personally and for some of the rumblings that no doubt you've been hearing
Oh yeah, there's a lot of rumblings for sure. It's a funny relationship. I got lucky in that I had two teachers who I think were very good people. One of them has passed away, but the other is still alive. And I studied directly with this guy Tim McCarthy and Gudo Nishijima Roshi in Japan, and I had a good relationship with them, and everything was okay. But there's a kind of a tendency in especially larger Buddhist organizations to get very hierarchical. And it's kind of a necessary evil in a way. You know, you can't run a big organization unless you know who's running it and how things are supposed to fit together and whose job is what. But this can easily kind of devolve into a sort of weird power structure where the teacher has a bunch of power and the student has no power. And sometimes there are abuses because people are the way people are. And I think it's important to try to avoid that. Like I say, it's lucky if you can keep things small, because in a smaller group, those things do happen occasionally, but it's harder because you're kind of much more intimate with your teachers and everything. So I don't know. When I see some of these scandals that go on, I often wonder if their organizations are getting too big, or there's also this tendency in the West for spiritual teachers to become kind of rock stars, and that creates problems because they often end up acting like rock stars, which is not really good for a spiritual teacher to do.
Absolutely correct. I totally agree on all counts. There tends to be something that I find very disturbing that happens with students, and that is that they will very quickly resolve their own individuality against whatever the teacher is saying. The teacher's perfect. Teacher has to be, and the teachers will walk right into that. Yeah. Western teachers, Eastern teachers, doesn't matter. Going to walk right into it.
It's difficult, and I've tried not to be that way, because both of my teachers were very good at sort of diffusing that. Especially my first teacher, Tim. He was almost too good at diffusing that, to where you couldn't. It was hard for me to even think of him as a teacher sometimes, because he would just kind of, destroy any image I had. But I can see it in the work that I do now, where I'm going leading these retreats, sometimes with people who I'll only see during that retreat, and they put a lot on me. And even though I'm trying to keep it off, they're trying to put me on this pedestal. I'm like, no, I'm not that. But I understand. There are some teachers who try to use that in a good way, to try to use the student's faith in them as a way to kind of help them through something. But it can easily slide into something strange, and that's why I'm a bit suspicious of it. So, I always try to push it away and just refuse all the power that people want to give me,
I think that's very healthy, because I think it must be extremely dangerous psychologically for anybody to adapt themselves to other people seeing them as something special.
And something, it really is.
Unless to me, the nature of a relationship is that has to be back and forth.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think you try to keep people equal. You try to keep things so that people are relating to each other as equals, even though... It is true that the teacher is the teacher for a reason, and ought to have something, but it's more like a matter of experience, because, if we're going to talk about enlightenment is kind of a universal thing that we all partake of. And somebody who has been kind of working with it for a few years has a bit of something that they can use to help another person get through that. But ultimately, we're all walking the same path, so the student isn't really lesser than the teacher. They're just a little bit, they've just joined the train a little bit later. But it's not the teacher that's going somewhere or that's leading them somewhere. They're taking a walk together through this thing, whatever it is.
This journey, this life, yeah. This extraordinary experience. Yes, this mystical time of being in the senses.
Yeah.
I think, though, that the thing that kind of concerns me is that people believe that somehow, and they put this on the teacher, as you've said, somehow that person has something that if I can make them like me, mm-hmm. if I can get them to participate with me, mm-hmm. if I can be good enough, if I can say yes enough. And so there's all kinds of abuses that are going on, sexual abuses, financial abuses, power abuses, exploitations. And it becomes very difficult then for the people who've experienced that to maintain their faith in the actual thing that was of importance in that circumstance. Would you agree to some of that?
Oh yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, that's it's sad that it goes that way, because I can kind of see it from both sides, because I've been the student and I've been the teacher. So I can see why students want to sort of, I don't know, throw themselves into a teacher and to be liked and all of that. But, you know, I find myself constantly trying to let people know that that's not the sort of relationship we need to have here. You know, it doesn't matter if I like you, you know, we're both walking this road, you know, and I try to keep it to that way, because there is that sense of you're trying to please the teacher or do something, you know, and I think that's natural. Everybody wants to be liked.
Well,
you know,
I think it's natural, but I also think it's relatively immature.
Yeah.
Because I think that the ultimate, well, not ultimate, but at some point, the teacher-student relationship, and again, I'm asking your response to this, is to get the other person who is not the teacher to wake up to what is going on inside them.
Yeah.
Which may not be what's going on inside the teacher. As I found with my teacher, it was very, very different. First of all, he was male. Secondly, he was just a very contentious human being. but he had tremendous power. It's an infantilized situation where the student goes into the child and lets the other become the parent, and the exact opposite has to happen. And yet, if you get rough with people, I'm a terrible teacher, by the way. I'm a total failure. I have like no students. People come and talk to me for 20 minutes and leave. I don't have meditations. Well, I have a very small group. I didn't mean to be disrespectful for them. They're very dear. But I don't travel around. Nobody takes me to Europe or any of those places. And I just kind of sit in my little house. And I'm kind of grateful for it. I think I'd be terrible if I ever got caught in that power stuff.
No, I think you're lucky, because you kind of do it the way my first teacher does it and still does it. You know, he's just in Ohio, and he doesn't leave, and he takes whoever shows up. It's really difficult, because that infantilization thing can happen, and I won't let people go there, and they really do try to go there, and some people, I even had an incident a few years ago where him, you know, treat me like his surrogate father, and then he got angry, you know, like really, really angry, and started going on the internet and trying to, you know, ruin my career as a writer and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I was just like, really, you know, all because I wouldn't accept this sort of father figure thing that he was trying to put on me, which it was for his sake, you know, it wasn't going to do him any good if he saw me as a father figure. So, So I understand how people get caught up in that,
yes.
You know, and I have a lot of sympathy.
Yes,
I don't have total sympathy with some of the people who become openly abusive with their students.
No.
But I can see how easy it is to go down that road without really even meaning to. So, you know,
yes.
I even have a bit
to be
of sympathy
seduced
there.
To be seduced by your own perception of your own power.
Yeah,
because these people are giving this to you, you know, and how difficult is that to hold on to your own humanity in that and your own imperfection. Luckily, in my case, the imperfections are multiple and I don't understand much of anything. So
you actually remind me a lot of Tim, my first teacher, because that was his attitude. And it's become weird for me because I wrote a book about it I've written several books now, but I wanted to be a writer. It was, you know, some dream I had ever since I was a teenager. And I was trying to write science fiction and other things. And I wrote a book about Zen as kind of I'd run out of science fiction ideas, and all my science fiction books had been rejected by publishers. So I wrote this book about Zen that when I finished it, I thought, well, this is, you know, if my other books didn't get published, this is certainly not going to get published because it's just punk rock, it had monster movies, it had all this other weird stuff in it. And I sent it out to some publishers thinking, well, that'll be that. And it got picked up, you know,
and
it became a career.
And so
now I have this thing which I never really intended to get into, which is a certain degree of fame. But I also tend to, my way of dealing with this is I often try to undercut whatever fame I have. You know, if I find, sometimes I'll express an unpopular opinion when I'm on the internet just because I know that'll cut a few people out of the out of my
tricky
fan base.
Tricky,
you know, I'm actually
yeah.
trying to push them out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is terrible financially, but you know, it helps psychologically.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's a very brave move to make. I have to tell you, this is just delightful, and I'm going to ask you to come back again.
Okay.
And we will talk about writing, because I want to know more about your writing process, how you got involved in such an unusual and interesting concept as letters to a dead friend about Zen. Would you
sure.
come back and speak with me again?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
Be
so,
glad to.
Thank you so much, Brad, for all your time. That's it. That's all for today. Many thanks to Kevin MacLeod for that lovely music, Carefree. And many thanks to all of you who make these podcasts possible. Remember, take good care of each other. Bye for now.